Matter of the New Jersey Coalition of Automotive Real Retailers versus Ford Motor Company. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Morning, Your Honor. Robert Columbus, on behalf of Ford Motor.
Morning, counsel, and welcome. Mr. Columbus, please.
May it please the court. Again, Robert Columbus on behalf of Ford Motor Company. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, please.
That's fine.
Thank you, Your Honors. The Franchise Practices Act is unique in both the rights that it creates and the mechanism that it uses to enforce those rights. The Act is a uniquely detailed and extensive regulation of the private contractual relationship between a franchisor and its franchisee. Among other things, it restricts the ability to terminate or transfer the franchise. And in the motor vehicle dealer context, it imposes a wide range of terms relating to nearly every aspect of the dealer's business. The right of action that the statute creates to enforce those rights is similarly aligned and focused on the relationship between a franchisee and its franchisor. Section 10 of the Act specifically states that any franchisee may bring an action to enforce the rights under the Act against its franchisor. Specificity in identifying the possible plaintiffs in Section 10 is unique. As the court is aware, most statutes are far more broad in identifying possible plaintiffs, using language along the lines of, for example, any injured person, or any aggrieved party, or any interested party. Those are the types of plaintiffs that typically can bring statutory cause of action. That's not what the legislature did in the Franchise Practices Act, though. And the legislature also made a more limited choice and limited grant of cause of action than the legislatures of other states have done in their Franchise Protection Acts. For example, Delaware, Pennsylvania, Georgia are all states that have granted an action under their Franchise Acts to any person. And in Georgia, there's a specific grant of the ability to bring a cause of action for associations of dealers. The New Jersey legislature made a different choice. It created a more limited cause of action under which claims are available to franchisees against their franchisors. Now, NJ Carr argues that associational standing allows it to circumvent that legislative choice. But allowing a non-franchisee like NJ Carr to bring the claim under the FPA would not only contravene the plain language of Section 10 of the Act, it would also nullify a complete statutory defense that the legislature has granted to franchisors under Section 9 of the Act. That provision gives franchisors a complete defense to liability if the plaintiff franchisee is in material breach of its franchise agreement. A franchisor can only use this defense if a franchisee is the plaintiff in the case. So, by way of example here, Ford could not use the defense in NJ Carr's case against it, because NJ Carr is not a franchisee and can't be in material breach of a franchise agreement. What the defense shows is that the legislature meant what it said in Section 10 when it limited the cause of action under the statute to a franchisee against its franchisor. And the cause of action would not function properly if any other plaintiff brought the claim, because the defense wouldn't be available. NJ Carr also argues that the defense would be available in follow-on actions to this one. Presuming that it could get a declaratory judgment in this action, other dealers could then try to enforce their rights as stated in the declaration in follow-on actions. That argument just proves that NJ Carr is not a proper plaintiff under the Act, because the defense that the legislature created is available in any action under the Act. But again, it's not available to Ford here. NJ Carr is trying to establish Ford's liability under the Act, and not just obtain a declaratory judgment, but obtain an injunction against Ford as well, without making this defense available in this case. NJ Carr's argument in this regard is also contrary to the purpose of the Declaratory Judgment Act. The purpose of a declaration is to resolve a dispute. NJ Carr's argument here is that this case will just spawn more litigation. That's judicially efficient. It's also unnecessary. If dealers want to bring this claim and make the allegation that Ford's Lincoln Commitment Program is a violation of the Franchise Protection Act, Franchise Practices Act, they're free to do so. According to NJ Carr, they have an economic incentive to do so. And the dealers certainly have the means and ability to bring such a claim. They haven't done so, and we don't need a two-step litigation process that's contrary to the plain terms of the act to address that. Now, for its part, the appellate division leaned on New Jersey's liberal approach to standing in its decision. But that liberal approach to standing doesn't override the basic principle that where the legislature creates statutory rights, it can also limit the parties who can enforce those rights. The legislature has the ability to say that this class of plaintiffs and no other class is permitted to bring an action under a statute for a claim that it creates. And that's exactly what the legislature did in the Franchise Practices Act through Section 10 in the express language there, and through the creation of the defense in Section 9. Allowing a non-franchisee like NJ Carr to pursue a claim under the act would create a cause of action that the legislature itself did not. Contrary to what NJ Carr claims, the arguments that Ford is making here would not eviscerate association standing, because the statutory standing principle that Ford is relying on is actually quite narrow, has a narrow application. NJ Carr does not have a claim, first, because the FPA specifies a particular identifiable class of plaintiffs, franchisees, not the more general classes of plaintiffs that most statutes identify. Again, injured persons, interested parties. That's not what is at issue here. And second, because of the defense that's available, which is unusual, because it's a complete defense, even if the franchisor is in violation of the act. Those two things together are unique and unlikely to be repeated often, if at all, in New Jersey law. It's particularly important to give effect to the limitation on statutory standing that the legislature has imposed, because private interests are at stake here. Again, the class of persons that the legislature identified as potential plaintiffs has the interest and the ability to bring a claim. Associational standing has a higher importance in public policy cases, or cases where there's public interests at stake that are non-economic in nature. The Franchise Protection Act governs entirely a private contractual economic relationship where both parties have an interest and ability in pursuing claims if they want to. And again, that's a limiting principle in terms of what Ford is arguing in this case. There is, I think, predictably no judicial decision before the appellate's decision in this one that has recognized that a non-franchisee has a statutory right under the act to bring a claim. In Tynan, the appellate division said that the act gives a remedy only to a, quote, specific class of persons, franchisees. Tynan and Horn, also an appellate division case, literally applied that statutory language to preclude a cause of action by prospective franchisees, even though in both cases it was clear that the prospective franchisees had a strong interest in enforcing the rights created by the act. The court in both cases still would not extend the language of Section 10 to include non-franchisees. It applied the act as written. And then in 2023, the District Court of New Jersey issued a case in an NJ Carr pled action against Mazda that's directly on point. In that case, the Third Circuit had found that NJ Carr did have associational standing, and it satisfied the three-part Hunt test for associational standing. But on remand, the district court found that despite that, even though there was associational standing, NJ Carr still could not pursue the FPA claim because it's not a franchisee. critically, NJ Carr did not appeal that decision. And now it argues that it was wrongly decided, but it didn't take that up to the Third Circuit. So it is the last best holding on the issue that's before the court.
It's an unpublished decision, correct?
It's an unpublished decision, yes.
Which means it doesn't get weight in this court, in this argument.
No, I disagree, Your Honor. It gets it has persuasive authority, same as if it was published. The court's not bound by the decision whether it was in published or not. But it is the only case that's addressed this issue in this context. And the fact that it found as it did, I think, is persuasive authority.
You're saying it's the only case. What about Daimler Chrysler from 1999 in the district court?
The difference in that case is that the statutory standing argument was simply not raised. All that was addressed there was whether the three-part associational standing argument was addressed. It found, just like in Mazda, that the Hunt test was satisfied, but they never got to the statutory standing question. So I take Your Honor's point that in that case, the association was allowed to proceed, but it was allowed to proceed without the argument being made that Ford is making in this case.
But the appellate division here relied on associational standing.
Correct.
So the statutory standing argument not being reached in that Daimler case is not all that important to our review of the appellate division's decision, is it?
No, I disagree, Your Honor, because the problem that the appellate division, that the error that it made here is that it just overlooked and conflated statutory standing with associational standing. So it relied on that 1999 decision, which didn't address statutory standing at all. It did not address the scope of the cause of action at all and whether it extended beyond franchisees. And it ignored the 2023 decision that addressed that very issue. The problem here is that there has been, and I think NJ Carr is perpetuating it in its briefing here, a conflation of these two concepts. Associational standing addresses the question of whether a live dispute is before the court and whether the court has before it a party who has a sufficient interest to litigate that live dispute. But statutory standing is really a question about, did the legislature grant this plaintiff a cause of action? Another way to say is, what is the scope of the cause of action? Who has the right under the statute to enforce the rights that the legislature created? That is the question that statutory standing raises. And we've argued under Section 10 that it's clear that only franchisees can bring in a claim under the statute against their franchisors. That's the plain language. And then on top of that, the statutory claim that the legislature has created only functions effectively if the defense is available.
Can I just
go ahead?
I understand your argument about statutory standing.
Yes.
Let me focus on associational standing for a minute. If they could show that there was the evidence in this case of the three Hunt prongs that you talked about, would there be associational standing?
If they could show that the three Hunt prongs were satisfied, there would be associational standing.
So let me go to the first prong. To satisfy the first prong, they have to show real or threatened injury to
yes,
their
sir.
Members, right?
Right.
Is there any evidence in this case that the LCP program caused that?
No, Your Honor.
Why is that?
This is our secondary argument. The reason is because what NJ Carr argues is the harm in this case, the real or threatened harm, is the competitive disadvantage that certain dealers will be put to as a result of the commitment program. The Lincoln Commitment Program makes certain offset payments for sales of cars, but to qualify for those offset payments, the dealers have to outlay costs. In order to determine whether the alleged harm exists, what we would need to understand is what the delta is for each dealer between the payments they're receiving and the costs that they've had to outlay to get those payments. And understand, do different dealers, are they getting different deltas for those two factors? All that NJ Carr has relied on here is the outlay, the offset payments themselves. So essentially what NJ Carr is arguing is the mere fact that different dealers get different amounts of offset payments is a harm. That's not right, because first of all, every dealer has the ability to get the same amounts. It's just based on car sales. And secondly, to understand if there's any competitive disadvantage, we need to know both sides of the equation. We need to line up the offset payments with the costs. NJ Car has not only not done that, it's refused to do that. The point of this lawsuit is that NJ Car is explicitly attempting to shield its dealers from any litigation, any discovery. And during discovery in this case, NJ Car admitted that it hasn't asked its dealers about its costs, doesn't have any information about its costs. All it has is a schedule of the offset payments that Ford's made, and it's relying on the fact that different dealers got different payments to make its harm argument. So,
but just to clarify an issue, as far as what happened at the trial court level, the spreadsheet that was produced was a schedule of the offset payments made pertaining to particular VIN numbers of the vehicles as they were being sold to consumers, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so that offset payment was tied to the vehicles, but we have no idea, and there's nothing in the record to suggest how that cost was calculated to determine the amount of the offset.
The offset, no, it is in the record how the offset payment is, if I'm understanding Your Honor's correct, because the offset payment is just a percentage of the price of the vehicle. So it's
right. But where did that amount come from? How was the choice made for that to be the amount? It was said in the record that it was based on the cost that a particular dealership would expend on fixing up their facility, on doing the car washes. But that there's not a dollar for dollar match to those costs.
That's correct. There is not a dollar for dollar match. What the program is in fact designed to, and it's designed to be more fair, is the attempt to not line up the dollar for dollar costs and payments. There are particular offset payments that are made as a percentage of the price of the vehicles. That's what Ford has agreed to make. Those are partial offsets for whatever cost the dealer has outlaid in order to qualify for those payments.
But if they're not the same, then to somebody looking at it from the outside, there's no real rhyme or reason why one dealership has more payments made to them based on the vehicles that they're selling versus another dealership, if it can't be measured by the cost that they're laying out.
Well, the intent is not to do a dollar to dollar match. And again, the reason for that is number one, so every dealer has the same opportunity to obtain the same offset payments from Ford, which is how it currently is. Number two, it would be administratively very difficult for a dealership to identify what particular costs are associated with the qualifying for the Lincoln Commitment Program. Number three, different dealers have different costs. I mean, we can say that a dealer in one location might have different costs than another dealer in a less expensive location, for example, to renovate its facilities. Dealers that are larger will have different costs than smaller dealers to do the same work. So the attempt here is to create an equal playing field, equal opportunity among all the dealers to obtain offset payments, which will partially offset the costs that they incur to engage in the program. And the key point here, Your Honor, is this whole program is voluntary. No dealer is required to outlay the costs in order to qualify for these payments. So if they decide to do that, if they make a determination on their own that it's economically viable and beneficial to incur the costs and then start getting these payments, they can do so. But the opportunity is there for all dealers to get the same payments. It's not intended to line up with the cost dollar for dollar. But again,
how would it work? Because there's renovation, there's car washes, there's loaners.
Yes, sir.
for buyers of Lincolns. Is that basically the gist of it?
Yes, sir.
So
it's certain facility, just with regard to the renovations, it's requirements and how the facility looks. Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead, please. Thank you. I know this was addressing your secondary argument. Can I get back to your primary argument and make sure that I correctly understand it? Is your point that, so first, standing is not constitutional in New Jersey. It is a prudential doctrine that is looking to whether the parties have a sufficient stake in the controversy and demonstrate real adverseness, correct?
Correct.
And your point is, even if for prudential reasons, an association would have standing to bring some other statutory claim where it doesn't specify who the proper plaintiff can be, or some sort of common law claim, this particular association cannot have, you're calling it standing, but has no cause of action to enforce this statute because the legislature created very specific statutory rights and determined that only franchisees had the power to enforce them. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. That's exactly our position. And you've got it correctly.
So whether there would be associational prudential standing, you are arguing, is just not relevant in this case because this is a very particular statute where the legislature specifically wrote that only one person could enforce it, and that is a franchisee.
Yes,
not one person, but one entity.
Yes, with just the modification, it is relevant to, we think they need to satisfy both. And our secondary argument is that NJ Carr hasn't satisfied the requirements for associational standing.
But that's only if we disagree with you on the statutory point. If we agreed with you on the statutory point that this particular statute can only be enforced by franchisees, then we wouldn't have to reach whether there would be prudential associational standing at all.
That's exactly right. And I think in the way Your Honor put the question is I would just like to amplify, because the Franchise Practices Act doesn't totally preempt common law claims. The franchisees or an association on behalf of franchisees could bring common law claims to enforce rights under the contract or potentially in tort, as long as they don't conflict with the statute. One could imagine a common law claim being brought by NJ Carr on behalf of its dealers. What our argument is that NJ Carr cannot, as a non-franchisee, bring the statutory cause of action.
An issue of standing? In other words, have you argued somewhere along the way that we don't even get to standing because this statute is so specific in the, it creates a statutory cause of action. There's no common law analog. It didn't exist before the FPA was filed. And this cause of action is only available if somebody meets the definition of a franchisee.
Yes, Your Honor. That is our argument. That's what we've argued. Now, I think what Your Honor may be picking up on, because I know I've picked up on it, is whether it's a misnomer to call this statutory standing.
That's what I'm wondering about.
I think
the statutory standing issues seem to come up in situations in which there are perhaps broader characterizations of who may bring the lawsuit, but the FPA is one of the most specific statutes that creates a civil cause of action.
Yes. Well, and so I agree with you. We have been using the argument that we're making is substantively exactly what Your Honor just articulated. Does this statutory cause of action exist for anyone other than franchisees? That is the argument. A shorthand for that argument in the case law is there statutory standing? And just to cite a case, a Third Circuit case, statutory standing addresses whether the legislature has accorded this injured plaintiff the right to sue the defendant to redress his injury. So that is our argument. And it might be better thought of as just a statutory interpretation question of what the scope of the cause of action is and who has the cause of action.
What was the Third Circuit case? I'm sorry.
That's the Third Circuit case. It's on page one of our brief, Graydon versus Context Systems, Inc., 496 F3rd 291. I mean, that's also the decision, the language in the Lexmark decision from the Supreme Court. This is the concept of statutory standing is asking this question, who has the cause of action under the statute?
So you do view this to be a standing question. To that extent,
whether and this the standing label, the statutory standing label, is just that, it's a label. The substantive question here is one of statutory interpretation. Did the legislature give any non-franchisees a cause of action under the Franchise Protection Practices Act. And again, it's not just Section 10, which specifies that a franchise and franchisee may bring an action against its franchisor. It's also Section 9, which contemplates that in any action under the Act, there's a complete defense to liability. If the franchisee, plaintiff, is in material violation of its franchise agreement.
Why doesn't your adversary have an argument with respect to the defense that the defense may win the day for you if there were a damages claim in this case? Because it seems to be almost an unclean hand sort of defense in the sense that you're seeking damages, but you're also in breach of your franchise contract, so you can't go there. But you only have an injunctive claim, or your adversary only has an injunctive claim here, and therefore a trade association should have the ability to bring a case on behalf of its members in order to stop a practice that might arguably violate the FPA.
Because, Your Honor, Section 9 doesn't mix and match or parse the availability of the defense in that way. It makes the defense available in any action brought by a franchisee, and that is all actions that are available under Section 10. So it doesn't, in every franchise case, there are many remedies that are available, injunctive or damages or potentially declaratory relief. Here, NJ Carr is just choosing two of those, a prospective relief, but that doesn't mean, that doesn't limit the availability of the defense under the language of Section 9.
The Consumer Fraud Act differentiates between injunctive and relief and actions for damages and sort of separates those. But this is a little bit different.
This is different, Your Honor. And honestly, I have not seen a statute that provides a defense of this nature. And that's because it's mimicking, it's addressing a contractual relationship. The whole statute is addressing the terms, the substantive terms of a private contractual relationship between private parties. And so the defense is built in there essentially as a prior material breach defense would be in a common law cause of action. But here we have a statutory cause of action. And when you extend it out beyond the private contractual relationship, that's the entire focus of this act and is specifically delineating the cause of action. When you extend it beyond that, the defense just falls away. It isn't there. And the idea of follow-on actions, it's going to be available once we get a declaration, then 18 dealers potentially can start to bring damages actions. I mean, that's completely inefficient. And that's not consistent with the Declaratory Judgment Act. One also wonders why those dealers haven't brought the actions now. If they actually have a claim and think that this truly is harming them, they have every incentive to bring the action and seek the relief. They could do it individually, they could do it jointly, they could do it with NJ Carr, but none of them have done that. And the record indicates that part of the reason for that may be that all of the dealers want the opportunity to obtain the offset payments. They all have the opportunity. They can, if they opt into this program, they have the opportunity to get offset payments by selling vehicles. It benefits them. So there is a question here about whether what the dealerships really think. And that's another layer to why we should apply the statute as written and require that the plaintiff be franchisees, not non-franchisees.
Your adversary might be arguing on that point that dealers don't generally, car dealers don't generally sue car companies unless there is something really egregious going on or a termination. It's just a relationship that they want to preserve, and that having the trade association take up this cause is a way to preserve those relationships. I haven't seen that in these papers, but that may be the reality of the concerns on the part of the individual dealerships.
I agree with Your Honor. That is an argument that NJ Carr made, at least in the appellate division. My response to that is that the Franchise Practices Act is extensive in the protections that it provides dealerships against any kind of retaliation. That is a huge portion of what the Franchise Practices Act is attempting to do, is to make sure that franchisors cannot abuse the relationship and can't retaliate, can't, for example, terminate without good cause, can't withhold approval for transfers for no good reason. So the Franchise Practices Act itself provides the protections that would allow for individual lawsuits if there were really an issue here.
Your argument rests heavily on the language of the statute, not on motives, which could vary. And some may cut in your favor and some may cut against you.
So. I agree with that, Your Honor. Our argument relies on the language of the statute, the existence of the defense. That's right.
So looking at that, is there a tension between the argument you're advancing about the language of the statute and In Re Team Academy Charter School, which dealt with the approval process for charter schools? The statute in that case, as you know, expressly said that local boards of education or charter school applicants could appeal the commissioner's decisions. And yet, ELEC, not identified in the statute, was permitted to present the claim.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there tension between that? Is there, if we accept your argument, what does that do to cases like Team Academy?
I think there is some tension between that outcome in this case, to be candid. But I would distinguish it in several ways. First of all, that case involved standing to appeal an administrative decision, not a statutory cause of action to bring a new case like this one. Secondly, that case obviously involved public rights, not a private contractual and economic relationship between private parties. Third, the parties who were being represented by the ELC in that case were, according to the appellate division itself, unlikely to be able to bring any claim on their own. There was really no ability for the affected students in the Newark School District to bring their own claims. And then fourth, the appellate division was quite frank about the fact that since this was a public interest case, it was allowing the slightest interest on the behalf of ELC to be sufficient to satisfy the standing requirements.
So you're suggesting that the language of the statute trumps other considerations unless there's public interest, which doesn't necessarily flow from the language here.
To be clear, Your Honor, I think that case was wrongly decided. I think that what flows from our argument is that, in fact, ELC did not have the ability to bring that appeal. However,
I take it you would argue that if this were a poor dealership or a dealership that was struggling, the fact that it couldn't afford legal fees and bring the suit would provide no leg for it to argue that the association could bring the case.
No, that's right, Your Honor. I think that case was wrongly decided. But if the court wants that case or that principle to stand alongside this one, it can, for two reasons. One is the language in this act, Section 10, is more specific about franchisees suing its franchisor. That is the claim that's alleged. Secondly, this case includes the defense, the complete defense to liability that's available in any action. And that wasn't at issue in the charter school case. Third, the fact that we have private contracting parties engaged in a economic relationship, I think, could be a third distinguishing factor. The point that I'd like to leave the court with on this question is that this is a narrow principle that we're arguing. If the court wants to leave the charter school context and similar issues in place, it can by just recognizing the narrowness of what's at stake here, which is the specific language of the Franchise Protection Act, the defense that's available, which is extremely unusual and maybe totally unique, and then the fact that we're talking about an economic relationship that's entirely regulated by a statute.
Can I just follow up on Justice Noriega's questions before with regard to how, I'm going back to your secondary argument, because I have to admit, I want to understand exactly how it works. If a dealership, a Lincoln dealership outside New York City, and you've got a Lincoln dealership in Vineland, right?
Right.
And if they sell the exact same make and model of car, are they getting the same and are participating in the LFP? Are they getting the exact same offset, or is that relative to their degree of participation in the LCP?
It's relative to their degree of participation in the sense there are three levels of participation in the LCP. But if we assume that the two dealers in your example are participating at the same levels, they get the same offsets.
And there's a location differential as well, right?
I believe that's right. But there, what there isn't is some is attempt to line up the costs between, you know, to do a dollar for dollar match. There's, other than what we've described, the levels, the payments would be the same.
So move my violin dealer up to right outside New York also. Same make and model of Lincoln, same level of investment, same location. Are they getting the same offset payment?
Yes.
And if they were not, under my hypo, you'd concede a violation of the statute, right?
I wouldn't concede a violation of the statute there. All we're talking about in the secondary argument, to be clear, is associational standing. We haven't, the question you just asked go to the merits, which are still now being remanded to the trial court, but I would concede that there would be harm.
So
harm for purposes of associational standing, not on the merits.
So would you concede that an adequate injury has been pled in that second hypo?
Yes.
To satisfy Hunt prong one?
Yes. If same level of participation, same location, different payments, then yes, I think now you've got the allegation is there's a competitive disadvantage from this program. The different payments would show that in some way. That's not the circumstances here, though. And in fact, the reason it's not circumstances is because NJ Carr hasn't produced that kind of evidence.
This is summary judgment, isn't it? We're at summary judgment. We're not under a printing mart.
Yes, you're right.
Standard.
Right, which is why the mere allegation, what the appellate division relied on, was just an allegation of harm. And we said at this stage, the evidence of when I'm talking about the costs and lining those costs up with the payments, that was evidence that NJ Carr had the burden to prove at this stage, because we are at summary judgment. The allegation and the complaint of harm wasn't sufficient to establish associational standing.
You said before that's not the circumstance of this case. In reality, it's not that that's not the circumstance. It's that we don't know if that's the circumstance, because that those allegations have not been pled, right?
Or I would say the proof is not there at this stage. Yes, but I agree with the correction.
You don't have the party that could provide the information, part of the information that would be relevant to that, right? If you had 18 actions, and I'm probably wishing that on you as a lawyer, but not for your client, if you had 18 separate actions by 18 dealerships, you would be able to, or presumably there will be discovery exchanged as those individual
right.
dealerships, and you'd be able to figure out whether there's harm.
Yes, that's right. And I would just, to bring this back to the defense, part of the problem with the appellate division's decision is it criticized Ford for not showing that the 18 member dealerships were in material violation of their franchise agreement, and said, well, the defense wouldn't even be available in this case because you haven't tried to show that. But there's no reason that Ford should need to litigate against 18 absent dealers who NJ Carr is intentionally shielding. We would have to go take discovery from those 18 parties. That is not what the statute contemplates in terms of how that defense is going to operate in the case. Rather, it is a defense against the plaintiff, who is a franchisee. So I agree with what Your Honor said with respect to harm, but it also applies to the argument about whether the cause of action extends to NJ Carr as well.
Counsel, why don't you have that information that could neutralize any argument, potential argument of injury? You know the cost. Do you know the cost at which the vehicle was sold? You know the level. You know the location. You know the offset payment. So why don't you have that information?
Because what we don't have is the cost structure of the dealerships. To show a competitive disadvantage here, what you would have to show is that look at both the cost side for the dealerships, what they outlaid in order to participate in the program, and what they're getting paid. And you would have to do that on a dealer by dealer basis. We know what Ford paid, and that's in the record. But what we don't have is any cost structure from the dealerships. Thank you.
Ford cross moved for summary judgment, right?
It did, Your Honor. I'm sorry, that's testing my memory, but I believe it did. But at this point, where we are in the merits is going back to the trial court to litigate the summary judgment issue on the merits, right. If they're standing.
Quick clarification question to an answer you gave to Justice Weiner. If we hold that only a franchisee can bring a statutory claim under the FPL, Do we go to associational standing still and address that?
No, Your Honor, you wouldn't need to. I think this is what I was discussing before. You wouldn't even have to get to that second question.
Okay.
Other questions, anyone? Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Bissell.
Your Honor, Your Honors, the arguments that Mr. Palumbos is making and Ford is making in this case ask this court to apply associational standing in a way it has never done so in the 50 plus years that it has existed in New Jersey jurisprudence. Moreover, it's asking this court to adopt a statutory standing standard for which there is not a single citation that I am aware of in the record that supports the arguments that Ford is making in this case. To understand what Ford is saying in this respect, you need look no further than the associational standing test that the appellate court applied, and in our belief, applied correctly. That associational standing test at the first prong looks at, does the member have standing to bring the claim? And if the member has standing to bring the claim, then the association can step into the shoes and represent the rights of its members. That has been what Hunt has held, even after Lexmark interjected statutory standing, and none of the statutory standing cases that are relied upon by Ford involve associational standing. Lexmark was a Lanham Act case where a printing company took Lexmark cartridges and refilled them, and they brought a false advertising claim under the Lanham Act as a counterclaim against Lexmark. There was no association there. It wasn't the association of we refill printer cartridges that you're trying to prevent us from doing so. Similarly, Graydon Conexant, no associational standing. So, Your Honors, this is a novel approach to associational standing in New Jersey and throughout the country. And I would point to a few cases that have been decided in New Jersey that address squarely the idea that the association itself needs to have an express grant of a statutory right to bring the claim. And these two cases are North Haledon Fire Company and the New Jersey Dental Association v. Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield. And specifically, I'd like to focus on the New Jersey Dental Association because that involved a statutory claim for recoupment and a claim pursuant to a contract that the Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield companies were taking back from the New Jersey Dental Association members. And in that case, the New Jersey Dental Association was allowed to stand in the place of its members and seek injunctive relief to recoup the payments and not to just recoup the payments, but to stop that.
And what was the statutory language there, counsel?
Your Honor, that case, the statutory language is not highlighted specifically in the case, but if you'll give me a moment.
Sorry, to the case.
The citation to the New Jersey Dental Association case is 2012 Westlaw 1948647. It's the Appellate Division, May 30th of 2012.
So it's an unpublished case.
I recognize that it's an unpublished case, Your Honor, but it is a case that is on point here. And
you say it's on point, but you also noted that the statutory language conferring the ability to bring a cause of action is not noted in that opinion.
Statutory standing is not discussed specifically in that case. And there's a reason for that. And that's because there were two individual dentists that were plaintiffs in that case, in addition to the association. And so the court doesn't even address statutory standing because the dentists have demonstrated that statutory standing.
So this is not, so this case doesn't sound like it's on point with our case.
But Your Honor, the idea that the association could actually maintain that action is the exact same principle that we're raising here.
It would only be that, obviously we're spending time on an unpublished opinion, but it would only be that if your lawsuit were dealer A, dealer B, an association. That would be the parallel to that one, it seems to me.
Well, Your Honor, that would be the parallel to that one because then we would not be discussing whether the franchisee has statutory standing here. But what I would respond to, Your Honor,
kind of a million-dollar question.
It seems to be, and I respect that, and I understand that. But it seems to me that where New Jersey is on the idea of associational standing and the liberal doctrine that it has used in that practice for a long time would not get hung up on the procedural formality of whether we had joined a dealer in this action.
But I think your adversary's argument is that regardless of New Jersey's liberal approach to standing in general, which, as we discussed, is you agree is a prudential and not constitutional doctrine in New Jersey, correct?
Yes.
So it's judge-made law about whether a lawsuit should go forward. It's not pursuant to the Constitution or any particular statute. There's no statute on standing generally. So regardless, your adversary's point is, regardless of what prudential standing doctrine would say in general, this particular statute says any franchisee may bring an action against its franchisor for violation of this act in the Superior Court of the state of New Jersey. And so their point is, you are not a franchisee, and so you may not bring an action against you don't even have an its franchisor for violation of this act in the Superior Court of the state of New Jersey. So call it whatever you want, call it whether the statute, the legislature created particular rights pursuant to statute and then created a very limited cause of action for who can enforce them. You can either call that statutory standing or you can call that something else. But their point is the statute does not grant you the right to sue under it. And you are trying to enforce that particular statute. If you were trying to enforce the common law, if you were trying to enforce some other statute, you'd be totally fine. But here you're trying to enforce a statute that does not give you the right to enforce it.
Yes, Your Honor. And that is why I brought up the New Jersey Dental Association case and also why I would point Your Honors to North Haldon.
But in the New Jersey Dental case, you didn't have any statutory language. So if you want, let's go to North Haldon. What's the statutory language there?
In North Haldon was a claim for withdrawals from a retirement account on behalf of the firefighters that make up the North Haldon Fire Company. And the borough in that case passed an ordinance that changed whether they had vested.
Sorry, you're talking about a borough ordinance. You're not talking about a statute.
Yes, Your Honor, but no statute provides a fire company union with the right to recoup payments.
But again, it's just not the particular argument that your adversary is making is you are trying to sue to enforce a statute that the legislature has deemed to create. And in creating it, they have been very specific as to who can enforce it. And that person is not you.
Yes, Your Honor, but there is not a single case in federal jurisprudence or in New Jersey jurisprudence that has applied that narrow read of statutory standing to a case where there is associational standing, because associational standing presupposes that the association has no harm and has no statutory ability to bring the case. That's Hunt's first prong.
It's the FPA is obviously one of the most franchisee protective Franchise Practices Act statutes in the country. Am I right about that?
Your Honor, I would say New Jersey definitely has significant amount of protections, but every single Franchise Practices Act around the country has similar protections. All 50 states have those.
But it's a very protective statute, and there's been a lot of litigation over the years under the FPA. Am I right about that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Published opinions. Has any trade association or association of franchisees ever attempted what your client is attempting here, as far as you can tell, based on the opinions that are out there?
Yes, Your Honor, they have. The Daimler-Chrysler case and the Mazda case were both situations that involved very similar programs, very similar actions. And the Daimler-Chrysler case found there to be associational standing. Mazda 2.
It's the same basic lawsuit there. But correct. Has anybody ever under the FPA, a trade association in a different setting, tried to have the trade association or whatever the association might be, in lieu of the franchisees, bring the action that you can, in terms of what your research has revealed?
Your Honor, there are cases that have been cited where that has happened, but they are not on all fours with the present case today. And
what was the outcome of those, just generically?
Well, for instance, in the case in the Northern District of Florida involving the Florida Association of Automotive Dealers, the court found that they could bring the action, but Florida's...
I'm sorry, I'm limiting this to our statute.
To New Jersey.
Yes.
Now, I've cited to you the two cases in addition to this one that I'm aware of in New Jersey.
Just curious. I'm just wondering why that is, and perhaps it's because the cause of action is fairly straightforward for the actual franchisee to bring, the way that the legislature set it up.
So, Your Honor, I would actually counter you on that point. And I would say that the reason that is because this statute that we are proceeding under here in New Jersey is very specific. And it is probably the most specific statute on incentive programs and per vehicle payments that exists in this country that I've seen. And what it says, and this addresses the secondary argument that some of your honors were asking Mr. Palumbos about, it says that you must sell a new motor vehicle at the same price and comparably equipped on the same terms with no differential in discount, allowance, credit, or bonus.
I think you're proving my point.
No.
All I'm saying is that it seems to me that on the substance, the legislature, if you qualify as a franchisee under the definition, the legislature has paved the way to your cause of action. I'm not addressing the merits of this one, but there are not procedural barriers to franchisees acting here. There is the defense, obviously, but the legislature has not made it procedurally difficult for a franchisee to bring the cause of action that you're bringing here, and it is perplexing as to why the procedural route your client's members have taken is to have the association be front and center here.
So, Your Honor, let me address this from a policy standpoint here. And it goes to what Mr. Palumbos has said. There was testimony in the record that every single member would like to continue to receive a payment for that. But that testimony in the record was followed up with, but that is not allowed under the statute as it exists in New Jersey.
I'm sorry. Every single member would like to do exactly what?
Continue receiving money under the program. But New Jersey disallowed these types of programs with this statute that we are proceeding
under.
That's
your argument.
It is our argument, Your Honor, and it is a merits question as to how you would apply the statute. And to understand why the New Jersey Association is attempting to uphold this statute is because these programs are rampant throughout the country.
Wait, I'm sorry.
You
just said that all of the franchisees want the program to continue?
That was the testimony that was in the record, Your Honor. But the reason they want...
Possibly have standing even under associational standing if they want the program to continue. And you're supposedly representing them.
Because the program divorces the costs of participating in the program from the benefits that are provided. This is the offset idea. And Ford presented no evidence related to what the offsets actually were. And what this is an economic principle.
That you're making an argument as to how the program violates the statute.
Yes.
What I'm not understanding is even under associational standing, if you represent the interests of various dealers and they all want the program to continue, how you could possibly be arguing that it shouldn't continue.
Despite them wanting the program to continue, there was a vote taken and they authorized the association to move forward with the lawsuit. And the reason they want...
The lawsuit says stop the program.
The lawsuit says stop the program into the future. Yes, Your Honor. And it says...
The answer to why the franchisees have not individually come forward as claimants.
Excuse me?
The fact that the franchisees want the program to continue, but your association does not, might be one of the reasons why the franchisees have not moved forward individually.
The specific testimony on that point is everybody would like to continue to receive money under the program. It doesn't mean that they believe that the program doesn't violate New Jersey law. And the reason...
Is there testimony as to whether or not they share the association's allegations that this program violates the law?
Well, Your Honor, in an associational standing case, the individual participation of the members would defeat the ability to have associational standing. Ford never sought discovery from them.
All I'm trying to get at is,
yes,
it's a little unusual for a trade association to be bringing an action or defending an action that the individual members of that association are not behind. Sometimes you have a trade association dealing with contrary views and it is trying to do what the majority wants. But what I think you're telling us is that the remedy that your client is seeking is not wanted by the members.
That is not the testimony, Your Honor. The testimony was that every member would obviously love to continue to receive the payments, but that the Lincoln members and the rest of the members of the association authorized this lawsuit to vindicate the statute because they believe that the program violates the statute on its face.
You said they voted in favor of the action. Who is the they?
The members of the association.
Including non-Lincoln members?
The Lincoln members authorized the action, Your Honor.
So the only voters were Lincoln members?
I do not believe that the testimony got to that granular level of detail in the record.
It's kind of
record
important
below.
Because I think what we are being presented here is that you have associational standing based upon Lincoln members who are that can be in it or in it.
That's,
if there are a bunch of other members of your organization who are perhaps selling Fords but not Lincolns, and don't like the treatment that Lincoln members are getting, and they are part of this mix, that complicates it, doesn't it?
Your Honor, I do not have the citation handy to the testimony that we're discussing, but it is in the record, and I can show you exactly where it was authorized and exactly how that testimony came out. And I'd be happy to submit a supplemental notice providing the citation to where that is in the summary judgment.
But I don't think you're answering Justice Patterson's question or Chief Justice Radner's question. The they is critical. If
for standing purposes, correct, Your Honor?
Right. If the they is all the members and not just the Lincoln member, then one of the possibilities of your argument is that the other 95% of the members may simply not like the incentive program that the Lincoln members have. And therefore, they want that program to stop, even though the Lincoln members don't, let me just finish, even though the Lincoln members don't want that program to stop. Now, if that were the case, and going back to, as Justice Wainwright pointed out, the critical its, right? Only franchisees can choose its franchisors. If that were the case, and the they was everybody, and not necessarily the Lincoln members, there'd clearly be no way to satisfy prong one of Hunt, because there'd be no way to satisfy the idea that these members who could have brought a suit on their own were injured.
I recognize exactly what Your Honor is saying, and that is that if members that had no franchise with Lincoln were behind bringing this action against Lincoln, then it would clearly abrogate the statutory right that's been granted.
Who is the association representing in this case?
The Lincoln dealers.
Only Lincoln dealers.
Correct.
And the other members had nothing to do with this?
It's an association, Your Honor. They're still a part of the association. But there is no ability for another member to bring that claim.
Well, I get that. But are you here representing, in part, is your client here representing in part the interests of non-Lincoln members who are perhaps understandably angry that Lincoln dealers are treated as a special class and get economic incentives?
No, Your Honor.
Did they have anything to do with it? Did the non-Lincoln members have anything to do with your client's decision to bring this lawsuit?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor, and I believe the testimony will vindicate it on that point. And the testimony was that there was a vote taken and that the suit was authorized, and that vote was taken with the Lincoln dealers.
Can we go back to the statute? Because
sure.
Mr. Palumbas's primary argument is that the statute does not, there is no available cause of action for an association, period.
Sure.
Pursuant to the statute. So we don't even need to get to associational standing. So we're spending a lot of time talking about the granular details of your testimony. I've heard from you what your strongest argument is with regard to why the statute allows the association to go forward. I know you began making the argument that there's no case that has done what your adversary is advocating, and then there are two cases that are on point with this case that go the opposite way. That's the New Jersey Dental Association, which is an unpublished that we've already determined is an unpublished appellate division case that does not involve, that doesn't reference the statute, and two dentists were parties in that case. And then you began speaking about the North Hallidon fire. I'm not sure if that's published or unpublished, but we do know that that also did not involve a statute and involved a borough ordinance. What is your argument for why this particular statute allows the association to bring a cause of action when the statute, as you have even agreed, is very specific and indicates that any franchisee may bring a cause of action?
So the statute does not expressly preclude or include the franchisee, the association, from bringing the action. And that was what the appellate division found, in that if the legislature had intended to preclude the association from bringing the action, it would have done so explicitly. And I think there's an implicit logic in that decision from the appellate court, and that is because associational standing is liberal and broad in New Jersey.
But it's rather reading of the statutory language that specifically says any franchisee may bring an action against its franchisor for violation of this act. How are you falling within that? Who is your franchisor, and you are not a franchisee within the definition of the statute?
The associational standing doctrine allows the association, in place of its member, to raise the claim that its member has.
So what court has held that even when a statute, when the legislature creates a particular statutory right and specifies that it can only be enforced by person A, that courts can expand upon that and say persons B, C, D, and E can all enforce the statute as well, as long as they're associations?
The Daimler-Chrysler case held that, Your Honor. And I would also say—
Your adversary said that the Daimler-Chrysler case had not considered the language of this particular statute. Do you disagree with that?
It considered the language in so much as it found that the association's members had standing to bring the suit under associational standing. And
no,
Your
but
Honor,
I'm not talking about associational standing. I'm talking about the statutory.
And I recognize that, Your Honor. And let's look at another case, okay. Pennsylvania Psychiatric Society v. Greenspring Health Services, okay. 280 Federal 3rd, 278. This case involves ERISA, and it applies the ERISA statute to the Psychiatric Society and says you can vindicate your client's claims under ERISA. You're not a beneficiary of the retirement fund. And this case is important, Your Honor, because this is what this case makes clear, that the reasoning in the Mazda 3 case, as you've seen it referred to in the briefing from 2023, was inapt by relying on AFL-CIO.
Remind me, please, because it's been a while since I've looked at ERISA for reasons of what courts get that. But what is the statutory language in ERISA that provides the cause of action? Obviously, a beneficiary has it.
It's the beneficiary under the plan. They are the ones who have the benefit under the plan, and the beneficiary can challenge it.
What does the language say?
Who can sue?
What does the language
say? It doesn't provide the ability for an association to...
I understand that, but who? Does it say a person or a beneficiary with a definition, or what does it say as to who can bring the cause of action?
I do not have that right offhand for you, Your Honor, but I believe that it says a beneficiary, and I believe in the similar way to what the Lexmark court was looking at in that case as it related to the Lanham Act, there's this overlay of, is this within the zone of protected interests?
Isn't the Lanham Act have very general standing language?
It does, but the uniqueness, of the claim is why Lexmark reached the issue that it did.
I'm probably wrong, but doesn't it say a person in the Lanham Act?
And
does it?
And I believe that is correct, Your Honor, but it has to be in a person injured by the action. And the claim was that this advertising to consumers in Lexmark was actually injuring the competitor of Lexmark. And that's why the court reached that very granular issue on statutory standing.
The Lanham Act is all about competitors.
It's about protecting consumers from it.
Right, but competitors are
no, there's two. There's the false advertising piece, and then there's also the trademark infringement piece. And this was under the false advertising piece, which goes directly to consumers, not to two competitors advertising against one another.
Your adversary also points out that the legislative history demonstrates here that the legislature was aware of other state FPA laws and how they set forth the ability to sue, and that in several states, it allows any person who is injured by a violation of the FPA to sue. It gives the example of Delaware. It gives the example of Pennsylvania, any person. And then it also points out that Georgia both says that any person injured can sue, and any corporation or association which is primarily owned or comprised of dealers and which primarily represents the interests of dealers shall have standing to file a petition or a cause of action for itself or for or on behalf of any dealer or group of dealers. So what do we make of the fact that the legislature knew these other states have similar laws, that they're granting either any person injured the right to sue or specifically calling out the ability of an association to sue on behalf of its members, and that our legislature chose to write that a franchisee has the ability to sue its franchisor.
Your Honor, am I understanding your question correct in that there is specific evidence in the legislative history that the legislature looked at those other state statutes and they allowed an association at that point in time to bring a lawsuit when they were writing the definitions for this specific statute?
I think that your adversary is pointing to the sponsor's statement to A2063 at page 4, which says a number of states already have moved to protect the interests of franchisors and franchisees by clearly defining the rights of each group in a manner vital to their economic existence. So I think their point is the legislature was aware that other states have similar laws, and from the sponsor's statement makes it seem like they had looked at those laws.
Thank you for that clarification, Your Honor. I will go to Georgia specifically, and I would point out that what Georgia's actually authorized there is something pretty unique, and that is the ability for the association to actually vindicate its members' rights for damages. And my second point on what Your Honor was saying as it relates to the other states is we do not, and there is not evidence in the record of how those states interpret associational standing. Okay, and the legislature in this case knew that associational standing was broad, and it would have known when it passed the laws that it needed to expressly preclude associational standing. That's why the silence doesn't get you.
Or expressly include associational standing. Well, I mean, you're making the argument that we should look at Section 10's first clause that any franchisee may bring an action against its franchisor and find that because that statement doesn't exclude associations, it doesn't, that associations can bring a cause of action. But you agree this can be read that the legislature was very clear in indicating that only a franchisee may bring an action against a franchisor.
And
that is a plain reading of this statute.
I think, Your Honor, there is, you could argue it does not expressly include, and you could argue it does not expressly exclude.
But I don't think there's an argument that it doesn't expressly include. It doesn't expressly include. That's what the plain language
fair, Your Honor. And where I'm going is that the associational standing jurisprudence allows the member to have the standing. It presupposes that the association itself does not have harm and does not have standing. That is the Hunt test. And despite the jurisprudence that has looked at statutory standing, none of that has done so in the context of associational standing.
But Hunt was not a statutory standing case. Hunt was a constitutional case under Article 3 of the United States Constitution, which says that courts may not hear if it is not a case or controversy. That, again, not relevant here because New Jersey doesn't have any constitutional standing requirement. It's purely prudential in New Jersey, but there was no statute at issue in Hunt that granted a cause of action to anyone, correct?
And that's correct, Your Honor. But since Hunt, there have been a number of other cases that have looked at this.
Could I just address one more on
Justice Winter after question? And that is, we cited in our briefing a case from the Southern District of Indiana, Indiana Protective Advocacy Services Commission v. Indiana Family Social and Services Administration. And that's 630 F sup 3rd 1022, and the Penn site is 1030. And I think this provides a very, very good elucidation of how the federal courts are viewing statutory standing in relation to Hunt and associational standing. And I'd note that this is in 2022 as well, so it's post-Lexmark. And it says the Hunt test would only be called into play for associations that lack statutory standing. That is our position. That is what the appellate division found. And that is what has been the law, to my understanding, in New Jersey for the better part of the last 50 years.
When you were talking about Georgia in the litany of statutes, you said that Georgia does something unusual. It gives the association the authority to bring an action for damages.
Correct. They have the full rights under the statute, okay. Your Honor.
Do you contend that your client has the right to sue for damages under the New Jersey Franchise Protection?
No, Your Honor, it would be incompatible with the associational standing doctrine because you can only seek declaratory and injunctive relief to avoid involving the individual members in the case. And
so
you could not bring a damages action without that. That's why our relief is prospective.
So you concede that the association cannot bring an action for damages under the NJFPA.
It would be inconsistent with the associational standing doctrine.
There's nothing in the statute that authorizes that.
The statute would authorize it per associational standing until you got to the third prong of the Hunt test.
Let's talk about just direct causes of action.
Let me just ask
the question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because I don't see the legislature differentiating between actions for damages and actions for injunctive and other relief in its language saying that a franchisee either has those causes of action. Am I right about that?
You're talking about the fact that the statute basically says for damages and or injunctive relief.
Right.
Yes.
So the same statutory language gives the members of your association, to the extent they qualify as franchisees and certainly accept your representation that they do, the ability to bring a damages action and an action for injunctive relief. But you can see that the association cannot do for damages what you are attempting to do here for injunctive relief.
Because we could not qualify for associational standing.
Why is that? Where in Hunt does it specifically say that it only applies to injunctive relief and not to a claim for damages?
That's from Worth v. Selden, which predated the Hunt case. And subsequent interpretations make very clear that you cannot maintain an action on behalf of your members as an association where individual participation of the members is required. And in order to ascertain damages, you would need individual participation of the members. And Your Honor, I think this is a good jumping off point to one other main point that Mr. Palumbos and Ford has made, and that is that this defense has been stripped away from them. And that is evidence of the legislature's intent to not provide associational standing in the context of the New Jersey Franchise Practices Act. As Your Honors recognize, that defense is essentially a analogous situation to the common law claim of if a party breaches the contract and the other party is in breach, the party breaching cannot recover. That defense does not prevent or does not allow the party that's being accused of violating a statute to continue to violate the statute in the future and or breach into the future.
Does that defense bar a claim for injunctive relief by the franchisee who is not in compliance with their contractual, and I'm purely talking about what the statutory language is. I'm not trying to overgeneralize it, but if the defense applies under the statutory language, can the franchisee bring an action for injunctive relief?
Well, Your Honor, there's kind of a there's a struggle there, right? Because
I don't see a struggle from
well, perspective. Your Honor, from a damages perspective, if you're seeking damages, you generally can't get injunctive relief unless the claim is continuing into the future.
So the answer is the answer to my question, it bars injunctive relief.
It would bar injunctive relief based on past actions, but a present continuing breach into the future.
It shall be a defense for a franchisor to any action, not an action for damages, to any action brought under this act by a franchisee, if it be shown that said franchisee has failed to substantially comply. That's section 9, and I didn't read all of it, but that's the beginning of section 9. That says any action. That doesn't say an action for damages.
But it's retrospective looking, it's not prospective looking, Your Honor. Failed to comply. If you fail to comply,
you cannot bring the suit. It's not saying if you fail to comply, you can get injunctive relief, but not damages.
So my read of that statute is codifying the common law principle of a breach of contract because in this statute essentially modifies the franchise agreement between the franchisees and the franchisors. The franchise agreements exist. And this statute is laid on top of the franchise agreements to grant the franchisees additional rights. And in order for the franchisees to be granted additional rights, the legislature determined that it did not need to preclude the ability for a franchisee's breach to allow the franchisor to escape liability under this statute
Does the Franchise Practices Act give franchisees rights that are not available in common law breach of contract actions? I think your answer would be waving the flag. Yes.
Well, Your Honor, there's rights provided under the Franchise Protection Act that aren't in the contracts, period. That is how they exist. That is why they exist. And in this situation, the idea that you could defend against continuing harm into the future because you can point to a breach 5 years ago is far beyond, I believe, what the New Jersey legislature was saying. And it definitely goes beyond the common law affirmative defense that a breaching party cannot recover.
Your position is that the defense is limited to damages actions? Or is there a subset of injunctive causes of action that would be barred by the defense if it's brought by a franchisee and if the franchisee is failed to substantially comply? I don't mean to generalize. I'm talking about situations where this applies.
So, Your Honor, I don't know practically that there could be a situation where there was not a past breach that there was injunctive relief being sought for. You would have to have the past ongoing action and the injunctive relief being sought, and the breach would prevent that. But Your Honor,
let me just ask it in a different way.
Sure.
Could a franchisee who has failed to substantially comply with requirements imposed, etc., under Section 9, bring an action to enjoin the Ford program as it now exists?
Could a franchisee bring a forward-looking action for simply declaratory and injunctive relief to end the Ford program?
Yes.
I would say yes, they could, Your Honor.
Even if that franchisee had had failed to substantially comply with requirements imposed by the franchise and other agreements ancillary or collateral.
I think if we wanted to get into that specific issue, it would depend on what the breach is. And I think the Mall Chevrolet case actually speaks to that. And that's a Third Circuit case. And in the Mall Chevrolet case in the Third Circuit, which is 99 Federal 4th 622, it talks about the purpose of the New Jersey Franchise Practices Act as the Third Circuit understands it. And it notes two main purposes, and it regulates the responsibilities of both the franchisee and the franchisor, and it protects innocent franchisees, not those in material breach. And it cites the Duncan case for that, which is a non-automotive franchise case. And in this case, Your Honor, NJ Carr is seeking to vindicate the first purpose, which is the rights and responsibilities of the franchisees as to the franchisors. And it's not preventing or harming the ability that Ford has to be protected from those that are in material breach. The dealers who are violating their dealer agreement are not specifically benefited by stopping the unlawful program. That benefits everybody. And if there is a subsequent action where a dealer wants to seek damages for a violation that the court has found is in violation of statute, then the dealer can bring that action and Ford can raise that defense.
Additional questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add, counsel?
Not at this time, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Palumbas, brief rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to start with the noting that the Mall Chevrolet case that Mr. Bissell just cited in with respect to the question of whether the defense precludes an injunction. That case included a request for injunctive and declaratory relief, and the Third Circuit held that that request was precluded by the defense. So I think that answers your question, Your Honor. And fundamentally, the question is whether the Franchise Practices Act as a whole precludes non-franchisees from proceeding, even under an associational standing theory. NJ Carr argues it doesn't. We have argued, and I think shown, that it does. Section 10, the language specifically referencing and providing for a cause of action by any franchisee against its franchisor is part one. Part two, we know that that was a meaningful limitation imposed by the legislature because of the defense in part three.
Associational standing only comes into play when there is no statutory standing for the association under the statute. So that the only time that associational standing is ever relevant is when the statute only grants a cause of action to a franchisee or an individual who is harmed, and then still courts hold that a association can come in and replace the person who the statute has specifically allowed to sue. How do you respond to that?
Well, this is where I think the question is really whether the statute and the language precludes the association from coming in. And in most situations, with a general grant of cause of action to any injured person or any interested party, the answer to that would be no, it's not necessarily precluded for an association to come in, stand in the shoes of an injured party and act as a plaintiff. But here, under the specific language of this act, it is precluded. That's the difference. This is a really uniquely specific act in terms of identifying a particular class of persons and only that class of persons who can bring a cause of action. And it's tied to the cause of action against the franchisee's franchisor. Again, it's aligned with the purpose of the statute, which is to govern the relationship between those two parties. And the cause of action reflects that.
How unique is the act? Have you canvassed the statutory scheme in this regard? I'm not looking to trip you up. I'm concerned about the breadth of your argument and its impact. How unique is this act?
I mean, we've seen the charter school case. We have not found other cases that are similar to this in New Jersey law. Some discussion about the ERISA case came up. That's another situation where we've seen it. I can tell you that the Third Circuit has conflicting case law as to whether associational standing is permitted in the ERISA context. The New Jersey State AFL-CIO case is a situation where the Third Circuit said the labor union could not proceed on behalf of a plan beneficiary because ERISA limited statutory standing to beneficiaries. There's certainly nothing in that the NJ Carr has cited or that the appellate division cited in this case that would suggest that a holding precluding a non-franchisee from proceeding here would extend beyond this context.
So what I've heard you say is you've canvassed the case law, but not done an exhaustive review of statutes.
We haven't reviewed the entire New Jersey statutory, you know, code to see if we could find something like this, but we have absolutely reviewed case law both in this state and nationally. The case that's most on point is the federal district case in the Mazda, the Mazda litigation with NJ Carr, where there was associational standing and there was no statutory standing. That is the case that's most on point. As a final point, I would just like to return to this factual question that came up because I think it's important. On page 128 of the appendix is where the testimony is that from NJ Carr's representative that every dealer wants to earn the funds without the threat of penalty that's engendered by the LCP. That's what we're relying on for every dealer wants to earn the funds. But then I would point the court also to 140 of the record, where the same witness testifies that the question is, would this lawsuit benefit them? And he says, well, I think it would. Whether they would acknowledge that, meaning the dealers, whether the dealers would acknowledge that, or whether they would understand that or not, is a different issue. And he says two lines later, I think all dealers would benefit from this action. Whether all dealers understand that at this juncture or not is the question. And that's really, that goes to the whole case. It's both the question of statutory standing and associational standing.
Who was this speaking?
This was the corporate representative for NJ Carr. And we don't even know if the dealers really want this case. We know that it's been brought by their purported representative, but that representative is saying they might not even understand the supposed benefit. All the court needs to do in this case is apply the statute as written, and these problems go away. If the cause of action is applied under the terms that the legislature provided, then there is no associational standing. Those dealers, should they want to bring this cause of action, can, and the cause of action will work as it's supposed to with the defense available to Ford.
Do we know how many members of the association there are and how many of them are Lincoln dealers?
All that I know, Your Honor, is that there are 18 Lincoln members of the association. I can't say that I know the full membership number.
Counselor, just to continue, though, on that page 128, they say the dealers don't want, or not they, I think it's the NJ Carr representative, says the dealers don't want to see it doled out in the way, and that's the distinction. They just don't like having to chase something on a per vehicle basis. So they do seem to be qualifying what you have said before in a manner consistent with your adversary, that they like the money, they just don't like to have to, they don't like to have that offsetting pay taken into consideration.
Well, this is the program that Ford is offering. The program is there are offset payments for costs associated with better customer service. That's the program that's being offered. It's completely voluntary. And 100 of the 700 Lincoln dealers in this country have opted out of it. So this is not something that they don't need to outlay these costs. But in order to get the offset payments, they need to qualify for them. That's what the program is. And they want the money. You're right. That's what that quote shows. But the program is to qualify for those payments. They need to meet the qualifications. They need to hit the certain levels of the program.
Right. But they want the money. They yeah. just don't want it tied to the vehicle cost. And they seem to be saying.
And they, if that is something that they want, they can bring a suit under Section 10, and they have the right to do that against their franchisor. But NJ Carr does not have that right.
Could the dealers all bring a suit as a class? Could all the Lincoln dealers bring a class action in this case?
I think they could all proceed jointly. Whether it would satisfy the numerosity question in a class action is something I haven't fully vetted, but they could certainly, 18 of them could be plaintiffs against Ford. some subset of that 18 could be plaintiffs, that would be no problem. Yeah.
Anything else you'd like to add in your rebuttal?
No, Your Honor. We'd ask that the court overturn the appellate division and affirm the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for the fine arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement.